I was thinking, you know, last year, or 3 years ago, we started with Oedipus and Hamlet. You know, not really cheery stuff. And then by the end of the conferences, we'd brightened up a little bit with a little Flannery O'Connor and well, see, that's how bright we got. this time we've started with a great deal of really a comedy. It's The Canterbury Tales is comic in nature. Midsummer Night's Dream is a great comedy. David Copperfield's comic. Here we go. We're just going to come down. We're going to land with a thud at the end of this year. But there's much I want to say about Long Day's Journey into Night, and it needs to be said. And it is the story of a lapsed Catholic American, and therefore there is much that needs to be said. So we just have to. So anyway, brace yourself for tonight, 7 o'clock. We are making one other shift here, and it's a gigantic shift. We're going from those great English writers and, if you will, coming home. The last two writers we will be talking about are both Americans. And the works and the lives cover an enormous span of American history. Emily Dickinson, born in 1830 and dies in 1886. Eugene O'Neill, born 2 years later in 1888, dies in 1953. So we have an enormous stretch of time covered by these two writers, and two very, very different writers. With Emily Dickinson, we have the Protestant young woman who was raised Calvinist and rejected Calvinism, but led an extremely ordered and disciplined and in its way, lovely life, at least in natural terms. With Eugene O'Neill, we have the lapsed Catholic who fell into total disorder and chaos and made life a misery for those around him, whereas Emily spent her years serving others, mainly in the home, but nevertheless a life of service to those that she loved. We've got very different things there, and it's very odd. should be said right at the beginning that if you look at the great writers in America in the 19th century, there is something of a curious pattern. I think there are three that stand out. This is my personal opinion. You would get some disagreement from others, particularly others who are professors of American literature. But then I'm speaking as a Catholic. And my vision of art has to do with how much truth comes out of a work, even if it is written by a non-Catholic. So that, to my mind, the great writers of the 19th century in America are Nathaniel Hawthorne, who spent his life trying to escape from the Puritanism that was his heritage, Herman Melville, who spent his life in rage at the Calvinism that he had been raised in, and attacking that vision of the Calvinist God, and Emily Dickinson, very quiet, very simple, leading a simple life, but disconnected from her family in a profound way, never committing to that Calvinism, and going on her own tiny exploration within books, her home, and the garden, and trying to make sense of everything that was around her, minus any sort of guidance. Very, very great writers. It is of some note that when we come to the 20th century, the great 20th century writers, and I think the greatest of them, hands down, is Flannery O'Connor, and followed not far behind by the great Walker Percy, we suddenly have Catholic writers. And I am convinced, absolutely convinced, as Our Lady of Guadalupe is the patroness of the Americas, and as real American history in some way begins with those great missionaries who went up the West Coast and then came here to the Midwest, that is a kind of promise. As our literature has turned increasingly Catholic, our great literature has turned increasingly Catholic, that is a sign that one day America will be Catholic. I'm just convinced of it, absolutely convinced of it. So we need to keep that in mind. Now, in the 19th century, there are two figures who share the title or debate the crown of great American poet. And they are Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson. And you could not find two more opposed visions, lifestyles, kinds of verse. They were both completely original, which is astonishing. With the incredible long history of English verse, going all the way from the Middle Ages up until that burst of poetry in the 19th century, with a number of great English poets, Blake and Coleridge and Wordsworth and Byron and Shelley and Keats and Tennyson and Browning, I mean, just astonishing, the great poets that came out of England. These two Americans read those poets, but forged something new and genuinely original. I don't want to say much about Whitman, but I do want to just a word or two by way of contrast in introduction to Emily Dickinson. Walt Whitman set himself up as the poet of the people. He viewed himself as the democratic poet. His years extend beyond Dickinson in both directions. He was born in 1819, died in 1892. He wandered the length and breadth of the country. he traveled extensively, went everywhere, met everyone. His verse is as huge and open and uncontrolled as is the landscape of America. We can take, I'll just hear very, very quickly, the opening of one of his poems, Out of the Cradle Endlessly Rocking. I'm just reading the first few lines of this. It's free verse. He's one of the founders of free verse. So there are not set patterns here. There are rhythms, there are not set patterns. I will indicate ends of lines just so you can hear them. Out of the cradle, endlessly rocking. Out of the mockingbird's throat, the musical shuttle. Out of the ninth month midnight. Over the sterile sands and the fields beyond where the child leaving his bed wandered alone, bareheaded, barefoot. That's one line. Enormous! And what happens in a Whitman poem is that at moments the lines just explode outward and become incredibly expansive to the point you don't think they're ever going to end. It's like driving through the state of Kansas, okay? It's just, this. there must be a limit to this somewhere, but where is it, okay? Just that sense of vast expanses. He claimed to be a poet of nature. He had one book of poems called Leaves of Grass, and he kept adding to it and adding to it and adding to it and adding to it. He viewed himself so that the book itself was like the individual lines. It just went on and on and on, and each new edition that he published had more poems and more poems and more poems, and he became more and more acclaimed, and he became larger and larger, and his beard got bigger and bigger, and his legend grew and grew, and his ego grew and grew, and he finally, you know, it comes to the point where he's writing a long poem called Song of Myself. And in that sense, he really is the poet of democracy, because what he ends up obsessing about, his own thoughts, his own emotions, his own vision, his own view of things, his own way of ordering the universe, and he becomes totally self-obsessed. Totally self-obsessed. And Song of Myself is a vision of Whitman becoming so enormous, and the vision having such wide scope and being so all-inclusive that he is America. He even goes beyond that. This is just, and it becomes grossly blasphemous. Little passage from Song of Myself. I have said that the soul is not more than the body, and I have said that the body is not more than the soul, and nothing, not God, is greater to one than one's self is. Woo! Woo! Well, you know, he went round the bend. Absolutely round the bend. He could write some great poetry. There are great poems scattered through Whitman. When Lincoln died, he was shattered, and he writes two great elegies to Lincoln, "O Captain, My Captain," a beautiful poem. Interestingly enough, it's formal. It has meter. It has rhyme. The other, "When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed," beautiful poem. He was capable of great beauty. If he'd had a measure of discipline and a little bit of humility, I think he could have been a great poet. This is, okay, there are many who disagree with me. My final image of Walt Whitman. There is a famous photo that was taken of him near the end of his life, which showed him, he's the crusty old philosopher, poet, wise man of America who's traveled all the country and knows it all. And he's sort of in an old shirt, and he's got his big bushy white beard and his white hair and this old floppy hat that's kept the sun out of his eyes. And he's outside, and sitting on his finger is a butterfly. He's the poet of nature who is so connected with nature that the little butterfly is sitting on his finger. Very famous photo. After his death, among the effects that they found was the butterfly with the little ring that would attach to his finger. Okay, that's Walt Whitman. That's Walt Whitman. Now, I'm being a bit unkind. Dip into Whitman, look at some of the shorter poems, look at the Lincoln elegies. He had talent. But boy, if you want the opposite number, there is the young woman called the Belle of Amherst. Let me give you a here's a little description she gives of herself in a letter she wrote. I'll go through the life in a bit of detail, but this is someone inquiring, who are you? What, you know, where do you come from? How do you live? Because she had sent off a handful of poems to a literary critic who was sort of stunned by them. Want to know who she was? Here's part of the response. She describes herself. "I am small, like the wren, and my hair is bold, like the chestnut burr, and my eyes like the sherry in the glass that the guest leaves." It's just wonderful. The eyes are sort of watery and not much left, not much color in them. It's just, I mean, "I went to school, but in your manner of the phrase, had no education." Boy, that's purely American. Oh, man. She may be one of the first to notice that. Let me repeat. "I went to school, but in your manner of the phrase, had no education. When a little girl, I had a friend who taught me immortality." Fascinating. "But venturing too near himself, he never returned. Soon after, my tutor died. And for several years, my lexicon was my only companion. Then I found one more. But he was not contented I be his scholar, so he left the land. You ask of my companions? Hills, sir, and the sundown, and a dog large as myself that my father bought me. They are better than beings because they know but do not tell. And the noise in the pool at noon excels my piano. But I fear my story fatigues you." You have the makings of the great poet in that. Odd little phrases, strange little uses of words, completely imaginative, where you have to stop and read it a couple of times to figure out what she's saying, but when you read it the second or third time, it makes perfect sense. But notice that sense of being absolutely alone, being completely isolated, and knowing that she doesn't know very much. Being very humble in her sense of any kind of knowledge or education she's received. She believes in immortality. Someone taught it to her. She doesn't even name the name. But when she tried to become too close to him, he never returned and soon after died. There's much speculation as to who it was. It's not even clear. The second friend, the second connection, okay? She found one more, the attachment of the heart, I think we could say, or friend. But he was not contented, I be his scholar, so he left the land. We think we know who that was. I'll come back to that. But basically, she lived at home in nature and looked around at the world around her, and it was a world that became increasingly isolated, even in its smallness. So that her world was never expansive, but as she makes clear, though they were the life she lived provided her with good companions, provided her with very good companions. It's a little vision of herself. Let me tell you quickly about her family. The Dickinson family was well known in Amherst, Massachusetts. They had been instrumental in setting up Amherst College. Her father was a very well-known man in the town, Edward Dickinson. He was a lawyer, highly respected. Her mother, who was also named Emily, very quiet soul. We know very little about her. Apparently, she simply oversaw domestic tasks, was a humble wife, and other than that, very little information. Although Emily writes in one of the letters, it's a beautiful tribute to her mother. She says, I was never close to my mother until her mother had a stroke late in life and was incapacitated for 7 years. And at that point, the daughter became the mother and took care of her mother for 7 years. And she says, I was never close to my mother until she became the child and I became her mother, and then we became close. Very, very interesting. But she took care of her mother for the 7 years before her mother died. Her father not only was a very famous lawyer in town, he was a graduate of Yale, but he also served in the state of Massachusetts legislature, and he served one term. He served one term in the United States Congress. He was a congressman from Amherst. For one term. There's a wonderful little comment in one of her letters where she says, you know, father's down there, he's a congressman, he's in Washington, and he's not even stealing anything from the government for us. That recognition that long ago, that if you're lucky enough to be sent to Congress, what you do is just milk the public dry. She was extraordinarily witty. It's delightful to read the letters, because these little things, just these little flashes of wit that come shooting out. Here's a description, a couple of words that she wrote about her father. Family was everything. Family was everything. Her father, her mother, an older brother, and a younger sister. Three children. Okay. Austin, the older brother, who also became a lawyer in Amherst and lived next door. Emily, and then her younger sister, Lavinia, who also never married, stayed in the house and took care of the father. And Emily and her sister, Vinnie, as she called her, close, but typically with two women who are close and living at home together, constant little bickering. I don't know if you know the Chinese symbol. You know, the Chinese have symbols for words. And the symbol, the Chinese symbol for trouble, is two women under one roof. I don't make that up. That's absolutely true. What you had with Emily and her sister Lavinia was not big trouble, but constant little bickering back and forth. Although obviously they were very dear to each other. So you had, and then Austin living next door, and he married a woman named Susan Gilbert, who became Emily's best friend. So her sister-in-law became her best friend and lived right next door. There was a little path that went between the two houses. And that's about the longest journey she would go on. As a young girl, she did once visit Washington and Philadelphia. And then late in life, she went on two occasions to an eye doctor in Boston because her eyes became very bad. Other than that, she never left Amherst. And for about the last half of her life, she never left the house. She became a recluse, and became something of a legend in Amherst. She refers in one of her letters to the other citizens of Amherst looking on her as Squire Dickinson's half-cracked daughter. but it was just a choice she made. The other eccentricity, she always dressed all in white, so that people would walk by and maybe see her moving by a window, and that would be the only glimpse they'd ever see of her. Emily all in white, or maybe out in the garden, and they could see her dressed all in white, but that was the only contact. Here again, little description of... I have a brother and sister. This is again describing herself in letters. I have a brother and sister. My mother does not care for thought, and father too busy with his briefs to notice what we do. He buys me many books, but begs me not to read them because he fears they joggle the mind. There's something just extraordinary there, having to do with American materialism and anti-intellectualism. You buy the books, you give them as gifts, but being a good father, he warns his daughter, don't read them. Who knows what ideas they might put in your head? Now, please notice, all of this, and this is the delightful part, is genuinely comic, okay? This is out of love of her father, who obviously was what? A pious... He was a good father. He was stern. He was a Calvinist. He obviously loved his family. But he had his own eccentricities. let me find the other. Here we are. My father only reads on Sunday. He reads lonely and rigorous books. She wrote another letter about her father after his death. His heart was pure and terrible, and I think no other like it exists. There's a description of a Calvinist. His heart was pure. He lived a good life. You couldn't accuse him of anything. His heart was pure and terrible. There was something in it of that knowledge, that belief in the wrath of God and predestination that made for a terrible heart, she says. Incredible. When I think of my father's lonely life, And his lonelier death, there is this redress, immortality. What you're going to find as you go through Dickinson is she is constantly trying to redefine things. She clings to the hope of immortality without having any full sense of what it is. We have a young woman trying to make her way through the mysterious, complex ideas of the 19th century in America, coupled with her rather serious reading of the Bible, Shakespeare, a number of older poets, older writers. She read widely and tried to make sense of it, but only so much direction she could give herself. Again, the last little comment about her father. The beautiful tribute here, again, comes from a letter. The last April that father lived, I mean below, again, that hope for immortality. There were several snowstorms, and the birds were so frightened and cold they sat by the kitchen door. Father went to the barn in his slippers and came back with a breakfast of grain for each, and hid himself while he scattered it, lest it embarrass them. Ignorant of the name or fate of their benefactor, their descendants are singing this afternoon. Just lovely. Just absolutely lovely. Again, an example of the witch. She got a letter from a woman whose son had just passed his oral exams at Columbia University Law School. I had this posted outside my office for a while. she said, "I am glad if Theodore balked the professors. Most such are mannequins, and a warm blow from a brave anatomy hurls them into wherefores." you give a good sound punch to one of those mannequin professors from a real soul, and they go, "Wherefore, wherefore, wherefore?" And that's one sentence. That's just one sentence. Absolutely, absolutely delightful. Her other... Her other escape, of course, was her poetry. It's not clear when she began writing it, but unknown Whitman, who became the national poet, she began writing, published, as I said, 1,775 poems. It's an extraordinary number. Seven of them she sent to a literary critic of the time named Thomas Wentworth Higginson, hoping for a little bit of recognition. Higginson was second rate. And what he saw was what he thought to be raw talent. She obviously had talent, but he wrote back, having corrected the poetry and taken out of it everything that was original. And Emily Dickinson is an extraordinary original poet. I'll give some of the details in just a moment. But basically, his impulse was that of the narrow-minded, second-rate literary critic that says all poetry must be exactly alike. So what he did was clean it up, change it, rearrange it, and tell her if she was going to write poetry in the future, it basically had to be like everybody else was writing. Now, at that time in America, the everybody else writing poetry, basically little lady poets, were turning out sentimental slop. But the notion was, say you've got some talent, you should write sentimental slop like all the other poets are writing. She was devastated. Now, Higginson did see that four of the poems were printed in, I think it was Harper's Monthly. They were ignored. That was all that was published in her lifetime. She responded, "Thank you for your surgery. It was not so painful as I supposed. While my thought is undressed, I can make the distinction. When I'm putting down my naked thoughts, when I'm putting down what I really think, I can understand what makes the poetry my own. But when I put them in the gown, okay, when I dress them up the way you want them dressed up, the way everybody else dresses up their poems, but when I put them in the gown, they look alike and numb." She couldn't do it. She couldn't do it. So she made the decision, rather than be published, rather than receive any sort of acclaim, she would just keep writing. So she began writing the poems, then doing nice handwritten copies and sewing them into little booklets of usually about 8 to 10 to 12 poems. And when one of the little booklets was complete, she put it in a box under her bed. Nobody knew. Nobody knew. They knew she did things up in her room at times alone, but reading or writing letters or whatnot. And after her death, her sister-in-law Sue, who had been her dear friend, in cleaning out the room, uncovered 1,775 poems. It's an astonishing story. It's absolutely astonishing. Dickinson herself was aware of this, and again, with a kind of beautiful humility, could even make a joke of it. This is number 85. 85 in the selected, if you've got a complete poems, this is 288. This is on page 47, poem 85, or 288 in the complete poems. "I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog. To tell one's name, the livelong June, to an admiring bog." Obviously it hurt not getting recognition, but she could look at the fact and basically make fun of herself. She had a clear sense of who she was. Number 194. This again is humility, but also a sense. Notice where this poem goes, almost to a kind of fear of life being meaningless. This is 194 in the selected, 486 if you've got the complete. If you've got the complete. I was the slightest in the house. I took the smallest room. At night, my little lamp and book and one geranium. So stationed, I could catch the mint that never ceased to fall. And just my basket, let me think. I'm sure that this was all. I never spoke unless addressed. And then 'twas brief and low. I could not bear to live aloud. The racket shamed me so. And if it had not been so far, and anyone I knew were going, I had often thought how noteless I could die. Ends on a real note of sadness. Let me say this. Every single one of the poems is different in some way. There are people who simply can't stand reading Dickinson, and I understand it. She is so unique, so strange, so special, such an acquired taste that some people are just simply put off. I understand that. I know people as well who don't like oysters. I feel very sorry for them. I think oysters are one of the most wonderful things on earth, but I can grasp people who look at an oyster and are repulsed and can't imagine swallowing it. I understand people who sit down and look at these little poems, that each one of which is a little riddle, a little intellectual journey, a small attempt to gain understanding, written in a peculiar manner, unlike poetry is usually written, and using words in such a personal way that they just can't read the stuff. They just can't read the stuff. I understand. I feel sorry for them. I think life is much fuller if I can sit and read a couple of Emily Dickinson poems and gulp oysters while doing it. In any case, I do understand that that reaction. Little more her vision of her own poetry. She wrote at length about her sense of herself as a poet. And notice this, there is a little sense, it's not quite fatalism, but just submission again to what's been decreed. Higgins, the correspondence with Higginson went on. And he kept saying, you know, if you can only get it right, we can publish some more. And she would say, well, you know, and she'd send him a few more. He'd say, you're just not doing it. You've got to learn how to do it. And she'd say, oh, well, you know, but I'm sending them off anyway. And then he says, you really should delay publication of these. You don't want to publish these now. And she says, I smile when you suggest that I delay to publish. That being foreign to my thought as firmament to fin. Love it. It's one. If fame belonged to me, I could not escape her. If she did not, the longest day would pass me on the chase, and the approbation of my dog would forsake me. Then my barefoot rank is better. Look, if I was supposed to be famous, I'd be famous. If I'm not supposed to be famous, then even not even my dog will pay any attention to me. My barefoot rank is better. Here I am. I'm just, you know, I accept it. Whatever it is. I think of this in contrast with, you know, the dozens and dozens of young poets who assault me every day with their verse. Everybody in America wants to be famous now. Everybody wants to be a celebrity. They are seeking immortality through art. They have in them the yearning toward immortality. They have lost belief. The only way they think they can become immortal is by becoming a famous writer. And then they will be immortal. Well, it doesn't work that way. Dickinson was obsessed with immortality. It was totally disconnected from fame. She did on occasion make a kind of religion of her art. There are poems where it's very clear her poetry becomes a substitute for religion But in a way, we understand it because she was desperately trying to figure out what the truth was. And after her years, when she was sent to Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, and was told, it was a Calvinist seminary, and she was told that she was to make her commitment to Christ the way all the other girls did, and she refused, causing a public scandal. Her father had to be brought in on it. From that point on, she simply refused to make that public commitment. It caused strain in the family. The other members of the family were worried about her, but she simply said, I cannot do it. The vision of the Calvinist God was something she could not accept. It did not square in any way with what she knew in herself, her feelings for other people, her views of nature, her intimations of immortality, to quote Wordsworth. She couldn't do it. But she could never settle anywhere else. In this sense, she links up with Melville. Two questing minds who rejected Calvinism and spent a lifetime out searching for the truth. It seems very curious to combine or compare Melville writing that huge novel about Ahab and the whale and Dickinson writing one of these little poems. But the link, and it is a link based in the fundamental 19th century American problem, is that the religious vision was not a truthful one. And most Americans just submitted to it, swallowed it whole, didn't question. You had here two enormously talented, enormously brilliant, and enormously troubled souls who went seeking. One on a whaling vessel out at sea, traveling to the Holy Lands, the other out in the garden at home taking care of her father and mother. But the problem was the same. There's something out there. There's truth out there. They never found it precisely. They had little moments when they come close, but they never were able to finally settle. A couple of times she struck back in terms of the poetry. Writing to Higginson again, you think my gait spasmodic. It is. She played with meter and rhythm. There is, the lines are doing weird things that poems weren't supposed to do. Look at an example in just a moment. I am in danger, sir. You think me uncontrolled. I have no tribunal. You're making these accusations against me. To whom can I appeal? That I know what I'm doing, and I'm doing it for a reason. She submitted a new batch of poems. She asks in mock humility, are these more orderly? I think you called me wayward. Will you help me improve? Okay. And then listen to this. This is something Melville didn't have to deal with. Melville was a man. He went out and he went in search. This was a humble female soul that knew her place was somehow domestic and in service to her father, at least. The couple of men that she formed attachments to, although she never really saw them, it was only through letters. But listen, I had no monarch in my life. Whew. It's the subject looking for a king. It is the woman looking for a husband. It is the proper desire to be told, to be ordered, to be led. And she rejected Higginson because she knew he was wrong. She knew more about poetry than he did. He was wrong. That's absolutely proper. Higginson had no authority in poetry over Emily Dickinson because he was second rate and didn't know. In poetry, she was the authority. I had no monarch in my life and cannot rule myself. And when I try to organize, my little force explodes and leaves me bare and charred. Writing those poems cost her because, as I said, they were explorations, okay? In each one of those little poems, it's wonderful. She tries to organize her little force and the poems explode. The amount of energy, life, thought, Imagination in those small poems is unbelievable. I love the image of her probably having finished writing one and feeling bare and charred. She has revealed her mind, she's revealed herself, and she's been burned by the fire of imagination that's gripped her. It's quite extraordinary. Quite an extraordinary statement. I want to look a little bit at what she was able to do let me see here. This is one I didn't ask you to read. I came upon it. I'll give you the number. This is in the selected poems 243 on page 149. In the complete poems 585. Number 585. This is a poem she wrote about the train. Trains went through Amherst, of course. She probably rode on one to go to Boston to see the eye doctor, maybe down with the early trip to Washington. But she obviously didn't spend much time on trains, but she obviously watched them. Look at this. This is just incredible. This is just incredible. And notice a couple of things here. What have we got? We have the peculiarities that mark her poetry. Number one, those dashes that are everywhere. She invented her own punctuation mark, the dash, and she peppers the poems with it, and obviously what it means is stop here. For some reason, take a break here. I am breaking up this line, and I'm doing it for a reason. Usually for emphasis, okay? Another way of emphasizing, she capitalizes words in the poems that otherwise wouldn't be capitalized. What are all those capital? It is emphasis. It's her way of shouting, this word is important. Pause on it. Look at it. Give it extra attention. And then, these bizarre off rhymes. They really come in a number of different ways or different forms. You've got the basic, she can rhyme. Obviously she could do it. There are many just straightforward rhymes. Then there are what we call off rhymes, those that are close, but not quite. Then there are sound rhymes where just the vowels may be similar, or you will even find rhymes, I don't know what we could call them, extended rhymes. She will rhyme words that end in NG, but have no other similarity, as if the rhyme should be the ng sound at the end. Again, it's the reason that Higginson must have fallen off his chair when he saw her doing that. You can't make a rhyme of ng and ng. And her response was, well, why can't I? If you draw out the word, you actually will have a rhyme, okay? Notice here, I'll just run through the rhymes in 243 or 585. Up and step. It's an off rhyme. What's she rhyming? She's simply rhyming the last sound. Second stanza. Peer and pair. Again, it's an off rhyme. It's more a visual rhyme on the page than anything else. The third one, suddenly the stanza expands to five lines. Suddenly the stanza grows and the rhyme is while and hill. Well, close, but the carny in the fairground would say no cigar. You know, it's just, that's not a hit, but it's deliberate. Why not, she says. And the last stanza, star and door. This is just, you didn't do this. Keats wouldn't have done that, even Whitman, when he's in his proper form and writing nice regular little poems, wouldn't have made weird rhymes like that. Poem about the train. I like to see it lap the miles and lick the valleys up and stop to feed itself at tanks and then prodigious step around a pile of mountains. And supercilious peer in shanties by the sides of roads, and then a quarry pair to find its ribs and crawl between, complaining all the while in horrid, hooting stanza, then chase itself downhill and neigh like Bowen urges, then, punctual as a star, stop. Docile and omnipotent at its own stable door. the amount of invention in there just makes your head ache. And by the end of the poem, we realize she's comparing the train to a horse. And of course, the wonderful thing is we have this vision of this mighty machine going out into the world. This is Emily. Where does it end up? Back at home at its own stable. It may make its journey, but it comes back to its stable. Just look at the first line. I like to see it lap the miles. Well, we stop there and what? By the way, this is all one sentence. Subject, I, verb, like, and all the rest of the poem is simply the extension of that, okay? Lap and stop, and lick and stop, and pair, one sentence, one long sentence. I like to see it lap the miles. We get the vision of a runner running laps, okay? And what the train seems to be doing is lapping the miles until we get to the second stanza and lick the valleys up. And suddenly we realize lap may mean something that the animal does when it takes liquid in. Sudden switches of meaning of words as you move from line to line and how she's playing with them. And stop to feed itself at tanks. The wonderful thing where the train has to stop at the station and have the water put into it. It's absolutely wonderful. I love, I'm jumping down. In horrid, complaining all the while, in horrid hooting stanza. It's the train, announces itself, whoo, whoo, in bursts, short, contained with space between, like a little poem. It's just wonderful. And the final stanza, and neigh like Boanerges, the connection between, the horse and one of the sons of thunder, then punctual as a star, stop, dash, landing on that first foot of the line and accenting it, and then the dash. Docile and omnipotent at its own stable door. Very sweet, very contained, all powerful, and the horse makes sense. It's all that contained energy, but when you get the horse back to the stable, it's calm, it's unmoving. It's a wonderful poem. Just a wonderful poem. Immense original vision about the coming of that powerful industry that's worth nothing unless it can somehow come home and really takes its value insofar as it is like something in God's creation, but the thing in God's creation is better because that's what we use to define the machine. It's wonderful. Wonderful inventive vision. A couple more things here. The two men that she was connected with, that she had affection for, let me put it this way, because we're talking epistolary relationships. One was named Otis Lord. He was a judge at the Supreme Court of Massachusetts. He was much older than she was. They met each other only a couple of times and talked, and she found someone she could be sympathetic with, who understood her mind a bit and found her delightful. They wrote letters back and forth. He was much older. Nothing ever came of it, other than a close friendship in letters. But he became the first place where her affections anchored, because being a young woman, she wanted that connection with a man. The second was Reverend Charles Wadsworth, who was a Presbyterian minister from Philadelphia, who stopped in Amherst, paid a visit. He was married. He had a family. They simply, again, became very close friends. She was deeply taken by him, and they wrote letters back. He then moved to California, took his family, moved to California. She never saw him again. But they wrote letters back and forth constantly for years. And he was, in one sense, I think, the most important man in her life. I want to look at a particular poem. 265 in the selected, 640 in the complete. 265. This is the longest poem she ever wrote. It's about 50 lines. It's clearly about Reverend Charles Wadsworth. It is one of the few times she, I think, almost crosses the line into a bit of 19th century sentimentality. You don't find it often in her poetry. Here, as she is considering her own situation, we get a touch of it. It's a great poem. I cannot live with you. It would be life. And life is over there, behind the shelf, the sexton keeps the key to. Putting up our life, his porcelain, like a cup, discarded of the housewife. Quaint or broke, a newer Severus pleases, old ones crack. I could not die with you, for one must wait to shut the other's gaze down. You could not. And I? Could I stand by and see you freeze without my right of frost, death's privilege? Nor could I rise with you, because your face would put out Jesus, that new grace grow plain and foreign on my homesick eye, except that you than he shone closer by. They'd judge us, how? For you served heaven, you know, or sought to, I could not. Because you saturated sight, and I had no more eyes for sordid excellence as paradise, and were you lost, I would be, though my name rang loudest on the heavenly fame. And were you saved, and I condemned to be where you were not, that self were hell to me. So we must meet apart, you there, I here, with just the door ajar that oceans are, and prayer. And that white sustenance, despair. She felt the pain of being alone, and it's very clear that it was a deep love. But she had her life; he had his wife and family. He was in California. There no question of anything other than her commitment and deep concern for this man. One other quick one along the same lines. They are very few of them are dark in this way, but we do have a couple of them. This one a tiny bit more hopeful. 424, number 424 selected in the complete 1123. What's very odd about this poem? Notice there's not a single dash until the end. We get the capitalizations, but no dashes till the end. So we don't know the nature of the disappointment, but my guess is it was connected with that feeling of loneliness and separation. A great hope fell. You heard no noise. The ruin was within. O cunning wreck that told no tale and let no witness in. The mind was built for mighty freight, for dread occasion planned. How often foundering at sea, ostensibly on land. A not admitting of the wound until it grew so wide that all my life had entered it and there were troughs beside. A closing of the simple lid that opened to the sun until the tender carpenter perpetual nail it down. There Christ becomes the loving carpenter who will finally place her in the coffin and end that pain that she feels. That's a the use of language, extraordinary. I just have a couple minutes here. Let's just do one for the fun of it. This is Dickinson. This is one of her most famous. An ability to take an idea explore it in verse, make it absolutely original and unique, and tell us something we knew but had never had expressed or explained with such remarkable originality and complexity. This is number 11. Number 11, number 67 in the complete poems. By the way, most of these poems written in a fairly short span of time. She turned them out just one after another after another. You've probably heard the first two lines. They become an American aphorism. Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory as he defeated, dying, on whose forbidden ear the distant strains of triumph burst agonized and clear. It's a great poem. Great poem. Nobody understands victory like the loser. Like the loser. Let me just point out a couple quick things here. She's making impact here in ways you're not even noticing. Look at how all five senses get evoked in this poem. Success is counted sweetest. The very first line, what have we got? Taste. Taste. Okay? And then to explore the image of taste, we've got the nectar. To comprehend a nectar requires sorest need. In order to taste the sweetness of the fruit, you've got to really need to, want to the point of aching for it. But the whole first stanza is built around taste, although there's something else buried there I'll come back to. Not one of all the purple host, why purple host? One, it suggests that the victory, the ones who win are somehow royal. But also, the use of the word purple just bursts on the eye. The way that the sound of strains of triumph at the end of the poem burst on the ear. Purple is a powerful color. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today. Notice touch. It's not the winning of the flag, it's what? Taking the flag, holding onto the flag. Who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory as he defeated dying on whose forbidden ear. Okay? We've got sound. We've got hearing. The distant strains of triumph burst, agonized and clear. The one that's missing? Smell. It's buried in the poem. Sorest. Not just painful or most needful, but it evokes the image of the sore, okay? The sore gets connected with dying. And in the final line, the sore bursts. And we smell the rot of death. Whew, it's just, she's incredible. She's absolutely incredible. We'll look at a few more. And what I'm going to do is group some of the other poems around her major ideas that she explores that set her apart from other 19th century writers.